Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. The Boardroom International Surfboard Show is coming up, presented by U.S. Blanks, May 2nd and 3rd at the Del Mar Fairgrounds, this multi-layered, consumer-facing surfboard manufacturing industry trade show features a hall filled with gorgeous surfboards, shapers, glassers, sanders, artists, board builders, and boards of all types, wetsuits, fins, tons of gear and art, May 2nd and 3rd at the Del Mar Fairgrounds. More info at boardroomshow.com. And this episode also brought to you by FYI CBD. My friends Caleb and John run FYI CBD, and you can get 20% off. Use promo code BOARDROOM20 at checkout for 20% off. Pure wellness. It begins with FYI CBD. Check it out, FYICBD.com. Also, the California Gold Surf Auction coming up May 2nd. Lots begin closing at noon Pacific Standard Time, May 2nd. We are already in the process of coalescing some absolutely gorgeous, unique, and culturally significant surfboards. I'm looking right now at one of Mark Fu's Waimea Bay boards that he rode during the Eddie Aikau Invitational. CaliforniaGoldSurfAuction.com. And as many of you know, I plan on going out to the Telos Islands this season to surf in the waters of Sumatra, Indonesia, at the newly built Monkeys Resort. It is a luxury resort providing better access to premier Telo Island waves. MonkeysResort.com. And finally, if you're listening in San Diego, do yourself a favor. Go check out Ranch 45 on Via de la Valle, just across from the racetrack next to Pamplemousse. I go to Ranch 45 all the time for my post-surf breakfast and lunch. They have premier food, a wonderful menu, and Pam, the owner, and their great chefs will cook you up a great meal. Check out Ranch 45 on Via de la Valle in Del Mar. Ranch45.com. A class act. That phrase gets thrown around a bit. He's a class act, one might say. He's a classy human being. Well, the gentleman on today's podcast, Bing Copeland, is, capital I, capital S, a class act. Intelligent, but with humility, witty, creative, smart, and sincere. If he hadn't caught the surf bug at age 14, Bing Copeland might have gone on to be a sports car engineer at General Motors, or perhaps a career State Department diplomat somewhere in Europe. But luckily for us and for him, he caught the surf bug and his life was set. The Boardroom Podcast with Bing Copeland. Let us begin. Bing, as a student, as a young student, were you better at math or were you better at English?
That's a good question. I was better at art and mechanical drawing and shops, like wood shop.
Right.
Those were my best.
Right.
Best classes in school.
Right. And tell me about your parents a little bit. I'm imagining growing up in Torrance, you sort of had like a standard American family with a mother that took care of the house and a father that was like an engineer or something like that.
Right. I was born in Torrance, but when I was, and my parents lived in Redondo at the time, and when I was 2 years old, they built a house in Manhattan Beach on 9th Street in Highland, and Manhattan Beach is two blocks from the beach. And that's where I basically grew up. That I remember growing up in, and all.
What were your parents? Oh, What did your dad do for work?
My father worked for a company called Air Research, and he also worked for the gas company, and he eventually opened his own hardware store Manhattan Beach.
And Air Research, was that sort of like part of the booming sort of aeronautical?
Yes, yeah, it was. Just after the war and all that. He was a technical writer, actually, for Air Research.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Whatever that means.
I think he wrote probably documentation. Maybe.
Yeah.
And your mom, she was just...
My mother worked for a doctor.
Siblings? Do you have brothers?
Yes, I have one older sister. It's 4 years older than me.
Oh, okay.
She's passed away now, but
yeah.
But that's the only sibling I had.
Right. You and I were speaking at Surf Expo. We were talking a little bit about getting older, and and you told me about your last wave.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about your last wave.
I recall my last wave. It was a little place in Baja. At the time, I still had a house in Baja that I would spend a lot of time in my winters there. And when I was 75 years old, I was surfing this little beach break spot that we enjoyed. I sort of had a reputation to uphold, and I didn't want to be seen surfing in a spot with a lot of guys. So, because I was most likely, I mean, you turn into a kook as you get older.
Right.
And I was having trouble getting to my feet, so consequently I was belly sliding a lot of waves. And this one last wave, I remember it was a fun little wave. I mean, when you're belly sliding, every wave's overhead.
Yeah, right.
And I was belly sliding in, and I got in near the shore break, and there were some rocks on the beach, and I thought, well, I better do an island pull out. So I grabbed the nose and tried to dig it in, and I couldn't make it, and finally it just washed up on the beach and broke the nose off. And I just kind of said to myself, you know, this is it. And I've talked to other people. I've talked to like Cap Jacobs and John McFarland and some of the other older guys that have said the same thing. They said they just suddenly realized that they're not having fun anymore. I mean, mostly it's because of physical limitations.
Yeah.
And it's just, you just can't really have a good time anymore, so it's time to hang it up.
Yeah.
And when I talk to younger guys in their 50s and 60s and well, I call them younger.
Thank you.
And I tell them that, you know, one day you'll realize that it's time to quit. And they go, oh, no, not me. I'm going to surf till I die.
Yeah.
But they're wrong.
Yeah.
You know, there is a limit.
And I'm fascinated by this because I'm mid-50s, yeah. And I often think about this, like, when does that time come? Because, as you know, your life is so wrapped around this concept of you being a surfer, the identity of being a surfer. And I guess we're always surfers, no matter what, till the day we die, even if we don't ride.
Yeah. You look at a wave, and you look for the curl, and you look for the section, and, you know, you don't look at waves the same once you're a surfer, but that's for sure.
Do you ever consider that being a surfer, the identity of a surfer, has kept you back from fulfilling maybe something that you wanted to go do in life, like because you were sort of attached to the coastline?
No, I think I was grateful that I was attached to the coastline and didn't have to go back behind the Pacific Coast Highway and get a real job. You know, that didn't appeal to me at all.
And was that always sort of the primary reasoning behind having a company and a livelihood in the surf industry? Was I need to stay in the water, and this is a means to an end.
It wasn't a plan. It just evolved that way.
Yeah.
You know, I was a surfer, you know, and then I did spend 2 years in the Coast Guard in Hawaii, and then a year sailing after that.
And was the Coast Guard a part of this, hey, we need to stay, you and Rick Stoner joined the Coast Guard together, I think it was in 55 or something like that.
We joined the Coast Guard when we were in high school. We joined the reserves.
And why was that? Was this a part of...
Well, because we wanted to avoid the draft.
Oh, interesting.
You know, I didn't want to be drafted into the Army and be in the infantry.
Was this during the Korean War?
This was between wars.
Yeah.
But they still had the draft.
Wow.
And they still were drafting people. So
what was your fear of the draft that led you to the Coast Guard?
I didn't want to be an Army guy and invading a beach somewhere.
Right.
You know, I wanted to be near the ocean, of course.
Yeah.
And the Coast Guard just seemed like an easy way out. It meant 2 years active duty instead of three or four, which is the Army, I guess. And we joined the reserves in high school, so we went to San Francisco for our 2 week physical training, and then that's all we really needed. And once we flew to Hawaii and we surfed for several months, we started running out of money. We decided we'll just go active in the Coast Guard, and they allowed us to stay there. So it was great. It was a wonderful. Wonderful way to spend my service.
Yeah, that's a really good plan. Now, when you went to, say, the Coast Guard facility in in Honolulu or whatever, and you said, okay, I'm here, I'm raising my hand for active duty, was it 90% sure that you got to stay in Hawaii?
It was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it wasn't a question.
Oh, that's great.
They said, no problem. We're going to sign you to a ship right here, and we, you know, we were docked right there at... right near the Aloha Tower.
Mm-hmm.
It's there, and so it was great. We got to surf Ala Moana every night after work.
Oh my God, you're laughing. Yeah. If you don't, listeners don't know, Bing's a goofy foot. So.
Yeah, I love to go left.
So that's fascinating. That and this was you and Rick Stoner.
Rick Stoner and myself. Yeah,
and you both sort of had this. Hey, man. This draft thing could come get us. Let's do the smart move here.
Absolutely. Everybody in my era.
What about Greg Knoll?
Well, somehow he avoided it.
Yeah.
But he's a conniver, as you know. No, I don't know how he avoided it, but maybe by getting married.
Oh,
you know,
interesting.
That could have been it.
Yeah. You mentioned prior to this you spent some time in Hawaii. I want to, and help me out with the years, but I want to say like 57, something like that, right?
55 to 57.
Okay. And you were in the Coast Guard, but prior to the Coast Guard, you spent like 9 months just surfing. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We went over surfing. I went over for the six guys, George Kapu, Sonny Vardaman, Rick Stoner. Oh, Steve Voorhees, another friend from school.
Yeah.
So
the South Bay crew of guys.
South Bay crew of guys, and we went first. We rented a little place in Waikiki on Liliuokalani Street, right up from Queens, and surfed Queens every day, two or three times.
Oh, man.
And, you know, no crowds. This is 1955.
Yeah.
And
Who's out in the water with you? Is there a rabbit kakai out in the water?
Well, not then, but we did run into rabbit later and those guys. But we basically surfed by ourselves at Queens.
Wow.
Almost, you know, just several times a day.
Yeah.
We'd go come in and rest or go get a couple scoops of rice or something. And
Does life get any better than that?
No, it was, you know, we were sleeping on the floor, you know, in sleeping bags and that kind of thing. I mean, it was crazy. But anyway, we were there for like 3 or 4 weeks, maybe, and then it was time, you know, we went in the fall, so it was time to move out to the country because we wanted to surf Makaha and that. So we went out, we bought an old rusty car and drove it out to Makaha, and we rented a Quonset hut at Makaha, and we stayed there for several months, and that's where we really got our introduction into riding bigger waves, and luckily... We got to work our way up. I mean, we were still, you know, just out of high school kids, and it was pretty frightening to think of riding big waves. But we got to, you know, we started in 5 or 6 foot waves, and we were surfing every day several times, and so we were in good enough shape. And as it got bigger, we just kind of grew with it. And you know, there was guys like George Downing was out when it was, you know, when the good times were there, and Peter Cole and those guys, and
And did you just watch those guys, or did they take you under?
We surfed with them and got advice from them.
Yeah, and were they friendly in that way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They were stoked to see young 19-year-old Californians having a good time?
Yeah, it wasn't a problem at all.
Right. Yeah. Do you recall
Buzzy Trent?
What was it like hanging out with Buzzy Trent or just surfing with him? I mean, did you get...
He was a good friend.
Yeah.
You know, that's all I can say. Yeah. It was a, you know, it was fun. He was a character.
Yeah. How many Quonset huts were there? It seems like everybody lived in a Quonset hut.
I think there was probably quite a lot left over from the war or something.
Was it in that valley there?
It's right behind the break. I mean, we could hear the when it got big, we could hear it when we were sleeping.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we were just a couple blocks basically from the beach.
And I think I saw in the movie, by the way, Bing has put out, Matt and Margaret Calvani and Bing Copeland and a crew of guys have put out a great movie that everyone should see. What's the name exactly of the movie?
Well, we had a hard time coming up with a name, and they ended up with the Think Bing. And it was a play off of a display ad we had in Surfer Magazine. It said Think Big, but then we just put one of those things in a...
Yeah.
And changed the big to Bing, put an N in it.
Right, right.
But anyway, everybody just started calling it the Think Bing movie, so that's the way that stuck.
Okay. And in the movie, there's a little section where Greg Knoll talks about first surfing YMA, like the one of the first sessions at big YMA, and you were out in the water. What was that like? I mean, what is YMA Bay like when you're 20 years old?
Well, it wasn't giant. It was big, but it wasn't.
Proper YMA, you mean? Like,
well, the whole thing is, we don't even know if it was really the first day. I mean, other people may have, who knows? There's other claims and everything.
Yeah.
All I know is I was out with Greg and Mike Stang and a couple of other guys, and it was pretty scary, but we were able to catch a wave, and you know, it wasn't a death-defying feat, but it was...
But it was a new barrier that you guys had broken down here.
Yeah. It was.
What was it? Where did you park back then in those days?
Oh, right on the street. There was no problem parking.
Yeah.
There was no crowds.
Right. There was no parking lot either.
Parking lot.
Yeah.
No, just on the road.
And you guys are like, look, it's too big for sunset. This is the only place where we can get out.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
That was basically it.
That sounds kind of spooky.
It was, but there's safety in numbers.
Yeah.
You know, so we kind of, I don't know if I would have gone if Greg hadn't gone.
Right.
You sort of go, well, I kind of have to now.
Oh, you know? Interesting.
So, but I could have just as easily stood on the street and watched the waves.
Yeah. Know? Yeah.
But he went in and Stang was going in. I went, oh boy, I better do it.
Right. So. Well, it's a fascinating, you know, just you in particular, the way that you sort of, your life is weaved in between all of these characters and their lives are weaved with you.
Right.
And I think of Greg Knoll, and of course, as we look on your website, you and Greg as teenagers hung out on the pier at Manhattan Beach. Somehow or another, you sort of were mentored by Dale Velzy.
Oh, absolutely.
Nope. And you worked for Dale Velzy. And
not for pay.
Which means, you worked for him.
Now, you know, Greg and I have been friends now for just over 70 years. I mean, I was 13 or 14, and he was a year younger than I was, and it was 1949 when I first met him. I was standing on the rail of the pier watching Velzy and some of the older guys surf. And in those days, they were just surfing paddle boards or cook boxes, you know, hollow cook boxes, and planks, balsa and redwood planks. And there was a...
Like Pacific Systems Homes boards?
Yes, that's what they were.
Yeah.
And so I was standing there watching him, and this young guy came up and stood beside me. And we started talking about the surf and this and that, and introduced ourselves, and it was Greg.
Yeah.
And in those days, he was about a foot shorter than I was and a lot skinnier.
Right.
Which has changed.
Right.
But anyway.
So Velzy
at that time was a lifeguard on the pier, too. And so he, one day when we were watching, he walked up to us and asked us if we wanted to try a board. So he said he had a 8'6".
These weren't foam boards. Solid wood, right?
Solid, balsa wood and redwood. Yeah, the one we tried, the first one we tried, it weighed about 85 pounds, and I don't think weighed much more than that.
Yeah.
And it was heavy, so we had to drag it through the sand to get it to the water, and, you know, you stop and rest once or twice.
Hey, just a quick break in the podcast to tell you about FYI CBD. A safe, legal, and 100% natural way to replenish the endocannabinoid system in your human body, resulting in unparalleled health benefits. CBD also stimulates appetite and relieves pain in those joints and in that back. FYICBD.com. Use promo code BOARDROOM20 at checkout for 20% off. Go there now, buy some FYICBD. BOARDROOM20, 20% off. FYICBD.com. Now back to the podcast.
Paddle that thing out. It's one of the things you lay on it, start paddling, and it takes about 5 or 6 strokes before the thing starts moving.
Right.
It's so heavy. So once you get it moving, then it's hard to stop.
Yeah.
But no, we ended up purling a bunch. And finally, I remember the first time I caught a wave and didn't purl, and I stood up and I was riding straight off into the beach. I was going, oh man, this is my sport. You know, I wanted to do this forever. You could just tell right then that's what I wanted to do. Yeah.
And working for Velzy Shop, is this where you sort of first got your like a taste of what the surfboard building industry might become? Did he teach you? What did you learn from Velzy?
When Greg and I started, Velzy hadn't started building boards yet. He was the lifeguard at the time. And then he started. He shaped a couple boards under the pier, and then he was making a mess with shavings and the balsa board shavings and so forth. And so he got flack from the city. So he went up and he rented a little shop, which was actually the very first surf shop on the coast, I think.
Right. Ever, really.
Yeah,
right up a history block, would
a
say.
Block up from the pier. And so that's where that was our hangout from then on. We would hang around there, and in the evenings, I mean, when I was like 15, 16, something like that, Velzy would go up to the liquor store and buy me a quart of Ole beer or something, and I could sit in there and drink beer with him and stuff. He also, I would cut templates for him first. He would draw the templates on the balsa blank, and I would get up there and stand up on it and cut the templates out. And I did a bunch of little things, swept the floor and all this and that, just hanging around. Just it was just an honor to be there. And he liked to drink coffee. He always smoked and drank coffee. And I never smoked, but I would go down and I learned to drink coffee with him. We'd go right down, just down one block from his shop was a place called Pearls. No, that's another restaurant in my history.
Yeah.
The White Stop Cafe. And we would go in there. Velzy would say, hey, Bingo, let's go down to Lulu's and get a cup of mud.
Yeah.
And so I go down there and I learned to drink coffee, learned to like it.
Yeah.
But and listen to his stories, you know, it was just classic.
And as far as building surfboards, you just saw, basically just, through osmosis, you saw him gluing blanks,
watching him shape them, you know. But I never, during that time, I never really thought that I would be building boards.
Yeah.
I had no thought of it. I'll tell you as we go a little along here where that feeling came in.
Sure, yeah. So you mentioned that you, after the Coast Guard, you and Rick Stoner, you got on a sailboat. Did you guys buy a boat?
No. Here's what happened. While we were in the Coast Guard, we were surfing Ala Moana all the time. And we parked our station wagon, which we slept in right there, at the parking lot at Ala Moana. We met a couple that had a yacht and started talking with them. They liked us and wanted us to to sail in some of the races on the weekend around in Honolulu. They had sailboat races. And so we crewed for him, and we got to be friends with them. And they gave us a key to the showers and the bathroom so we could park our station wagon right there. And we had our hot showers. And
did you learn to sail from these people, or did you learn to sail in the
Coast Guard? I learned to sail prior to that. I learned to sail in Sabots at Portuguese Bend Club. When I was...
Which is Palos Verdes.
Young. Palos Verdes, yeah. And then we sailed a little catamaran, outrigger that we had. We sailed it in the Alloway Canal. These people were just became friends, you know, and they were older than we were.
Do you remember these people?
Oh, very well.
Yeah, I just recently,
Bill and Jean Schallenberg.
Oh, okay.
And I just the other day had breakfast with their granddaughter, who I'd never met.
Right.
But she looked me up, and I was in Redondo Beach. And
how great is that?
I had her down. She didn't drive, so she spent $40 on a lift to get there.
Right.
And I'm sitting there buying her breakfast, and we're talking about her grandfather and her grandmother and all of our experiences. I was showing her my pictures, and she showed me a couple pictures of me, actually, that I hadn't seen before. And so I felt kind of guilty for her after spending all that money to get down to see me, so I gave her $20 to go back, or $40 to go back, $220s. Right.
So this couple, the Schallenbergers, they had you and Rick crew for them. And so did you, were they on the boat with you?
Or? Here's what happened. Yeah, absolutely. Once we got out of the Coast Guard, which was the end of 57, we returned to California and got our lifeguard jobs back where we could work. So in the spring of 58, we were lifeguarding, and they had visited their family in the East, and they were coming through California, and they just stopped and said, "We're going to sail around the world. You guys want to be our crew?" And we said, "Sure." We dropped everything and got a year's leave of absence from the lifeguards, and flew back to Honolulu with them, and worked on the boat for a while, and then we set off for Tahiti.
How big was this boat?
The boat was about 38 feet.
Small boat.
Yeah.
Four people
and a one-year-old baby.
Wow. Yeah. How old were the Schallenbergs at this time?
That's a good question. They were at least 5 or 6 years older than.
Right, so maybe 28 or 30 or something like that.
Yeah, And they had the one-year-old Billy, was his name. And we put, there was all cloth diapers in those days for kids like that. So we took and folded a corner over the cloth diaper and put a brass grommet in it so you could
hang it over
the tail of the boat and let it well, of course they rinsed it out in fresh water, but that's how they cleaned the diapers, just dragging them behind the boat.
That's fascinating.
Anyway, we were 29 days without seeing another sign of life, another boat, airplane, nothing.
I know that feeling.
Unbelievable.
It's pretty incredible.
But then we spent a month or so in Tahiti and enjoyed that. In fact, we really enjoyed it.
How long did you stay in Tahiti?
We were there about a month.
And as surfers, did you get waves?
We didn't know there was waves.
Yeah.
We rented motorbikes and rode around the island, never saw a surfable wave.
Yeah.
So we didn't know about
outer reefs,
Tutahu and all that.
Right.
Yeah. No, we... So we had our surfboards.
Yeah.
And in fact, we had them on the
What kind of boards did you have with you on
this
boat?
We had Velzy balsa boards.
Balsa, Velzys.
Yeah, the pig shape. That was just the beginning.
Were they chambered or no?
Just the beginning, no.
Back then, they didn't chamber balsa.
No. Just in the beginning of the pig shape.
Okay.
In
good 50, boards.
59.
Good turning boards.
They were great.
Yeah.
In fact, our two boards are still, I'll go on to this.
Where are they?
Well, they're hanging in the surf club at the Piha Surf Lifesaving headquarters.
In New Zealand.
In Piha, New Zealand.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, what happens is after we left Tahiti, we were sailing off, and in their boat, their masts split. We were right just outside of Moorea, and they had to go back to Tahiti. Rick and I knew we had to get back within a year to keep our lifeguard jobs, so we got off their boat and signed on with an Australian 69-year-old retired harbor pilot from Australia, from Brisbane, Australia, I guess he was from. And he had four young Australian guys on, and we went on, and we were the six of us. I mean, it was a pretty rowdy group.
I bet. And it must have been a bigger boat.
It was a bigger boat, yeah. So we sailed with them, and we ended up on Thanksgiving Day of 1957 in Auckland, New Zealand. And Rick and I met a couple of young guys that were on the dock, and we asked if there was any surf, and they said, oh, yeah, on the other side, on the Tasman side, and over at Piha, the waves are good. And so they said, do you want to go? And we said, sure. And they said, we'll take you there. So the next day they came, and we loaded our boards onto their car. And this was our first experience driving on the other side of the road.
Right.
So that was weird.
Yeah.
And we drove up there. And as we were coming down the hill into Piha, Rick and I saw these waves that kind of looked like, you know, it was like 5 foot, 6 foot maybe, San Onofre kind of waves. I mean, they look great.
Yeah.
So they drove us up to the surf club, and we got out and kind of introduced ourselves to the surf life-saving club members. Yeah. They didn't have surfboards. All they had was called a surf ski.
Yeah.
You know, with a big 14-foot long, big scoop in the nose and a rope and a double-bladed paddle and foot straps. And
yeah.
They would stand and go straight off. So we said, you know, we'd like to try your surf. And they said, well, the waves are really dangerous, but we'll send a couple guys out on the surf skis to watch out for you. And so we said, okay, whatever. And anyway, it turns out we got out and they didn't. Because we could turn turtle and go into waves. And,
sure.
And
they didn't know how good you guys were.
And then Rick and I just caught, you know, half a dozen waves, 8 or 10 waves maybe at the most. And we kind of did, kind of showing off, because there were a lot of guys on the beach watching, and we were going behind each other and kicking out and doing all the stuff you do.
Yeah.
And they just went crazy.
Yeah.
When we came in, the guys were neck deep in the water going, give me a go, mate.
Yeah.
You know, they all wanted
to
try the boards.
At the bed, huh?
So our boards literally never left the water for the next, I don't know, the next couple weeks anyway. I
mean, yeah.
During the daylight hours, somebody was riding our boards.
Wow.
So Rick and I are going, you know, these guys need some surfboards.
Yeah.
And so we had friends with this young fellow who had a...
Did any of the Kiwis say, hey, we have seen this type of surfing before?
No.
I mean,
no.
I think this is sort of an underrated part of surf history that Bing Copeland and Rick Stoner introduced stand-up surfing to the Kiwis.
Not stand-up. Stand-up is...
Well, I mean...
Yeah.
I mean...
Surfing, the modern-day surfboard.
Yeah, the modern-day surfboard. Yeah, and because they weren't standing up on their surf skis, they were on their butts.
However, what's interesting about that is 2 years prior to that, Greg and a bunch of guys went to Australia
right.
and introduced the modern board.
Right.
And 2 years later...
It hadn't jumped over.
It hadn't jumped over. You know, without the internet and this, you know, that social media, you know...
Right.
The word doesn't travel as fast in those days.
So it was 2 years later. A stretch, right? I mean, that's the history's the history, right? You guys.
Oh, yeah, we did.
Yeah, and to me, that's sort of unknown.
In fact, 50 years after the 50-year anniversary of us introducing surfboards, they sent a ticket to my wife and I to come over, and we had a week-long celebration. We got a key to the city.
That's so great. I was going to ask you about this. I hope that they took that they acknowledge it. They're just like, these are the two guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like the father of Kiwi surfing.
No.
You are.
Yeah, yeah. Not, you know, they surfed, but they didn't surf on the kind of boards we had.
But they weren't standing up. They were sitting on their
They'd stand up.
Oh, they would stand
hold
up.
Hold the paddle and that kind of thing.
Oh, they did stand up. I thought they were on their butt.
Kind of parallel stance and go straight off.
Right.
And the rope kind of was taut from the, you know, so they could lean back on it. Anyways.
But they weren't using the rail and riding a modern pig surfing off
they
the
thing no
or whatever.
Yeah.
This is cool.
So, cool. Yeah, so we're kind of famous over there for having started all that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great honor. I mean,
Cool, good stuff.
Yeah,
is Rick Stoner still with us? Or
no, Rick died. He had a brain hemorrhage or something in his probably in his 50s, late 50s, early 60s.
Oh, okay, wow.
Yeah.
Hey, a quick break in the podcast to tell you about Monkey Surf Resort in the Telos Islands in Sumatra, Indonesia, providing better access to premier Telo Island waves. I'm going to be going out to the Monkey's Resort this season. I'm extremely excited about it. I've been to the Telos Islands before. There are tons of super good waves, and I'm going to do my best to get into a few of those at the Monkey's Resort. Monkeysresort.com, providing better access to premier Telo Island waves. Check them out, monkeysresort.com. And now back to the podcast. And were you close with him?
Very close.
Yeah, up until...
Yeah, we were in each other's weddings. And
we're talking, for the listeners that don't know, if you've seen the Rick Surfboards label, that's Rick Stoner, right. Rick Surfboards. Yeah. And he was a lifeguard for a long time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he died as a lifeguard, yeah.
Yeah.
Permanently. Well, in fact, we started my surfboard business when we came back from New Zealand. After building those boards, we felt we could do it. So when we came back, we started shaping some boards and reshaping some old balsa boards and stuff in my parents' garage. And we thought, well, let's build some new boards. So we found some styrofoam and epoxy, and we were building some styrofoam and epoxy boards in my parents' garage. And then we started making too much noise and dust and smell, and we got kicked out. So we started a little shop on the Strand in Hermosa Beach, right by the Biltmore Hotel there, right on the beach, and started building boards. And that was right when Walker started blowing foam.
So, I was just going to ask you about the concept of being in New Zealand and finding foam.
Yeah.
Obviously, the idea of building boards in this way, this type of construction, this type of fabrication, you knew that foam was the ideal core when you're sailing in New Zealand.
Yeah.
When did all that come about?
Like, I don't really know. All I know is that styrofoam was the only thing we could get.
Right. But your boards were wood boards. The boards you had on the sailboat.
They were balsa boards. Yeah.
Balsa.
Yeah.
And you get to New Zealand and you're like, we don't need wood. We can just use foam. I mean, that seems like a big leap, like to find.
Well, we knew that styrofoam and epoxy glassing would work.
Right.
For some reason, I don't know where we learned that, but that's what we did.
Yeah.
And we built
maybe it's because of the Kiwi culture, so sailing oriented and so boat building oriented, that their culture there, maybe they're like, hey, let's just use boat resin, you guys, and we've got some, I don't know.
It could be. Who knows? I don't recall. Other than I know that this Peter Byers that we met, who had a tomato patch there. I mean, he grew tomatoes commercially, actually. And he was really interested, and he took us into Auckland, and we found the materials that we needed. We shaped the styrofoam we cut out the templates, and then it was all block. You know, it isn't a blank
like
we have today. And we shaped with a cheese grater and sandpaper and this and that, and they were kind of crude, but they were okay. You know, and I remember thinking to myself, you know, having watched Velzy so much, and I'm thinking to myself, hey, you know, I can do this.
Yeah.
I can build surfboards. So when we came back in 59.
You're strictly now foam and fiberglass cloth and resin. You're not even thinking wood at this
point. No.
Because Walker's blowing foam.
Yeah, Walker was, at that time, Walker had just started blowing foam.
Was he in the South Bay?
No. Velzy and everybody was starting to use it. Yeah, that's what we used, and it ends up, I was on this nice little shop in the Strands right next to a restaurant. It was really cool. You know, Rick and I, it was Bing and Rick at the time, and eventually Rick decided he was going to get married, and he thought it would be smarter to be a permanent lifeguard, which better, more security, which I understood, and so I bought him out at that time, within the first year.
Yeah.
And just changed it to Surfboards by Bing, and then Bing Surfboards eventually.
That era, that early 60s to mid 60s in the South Bay, you've got Velzy, you've got Hap Jacobs Surfboards, you've got Greg Knoll Surfboards, you've got Bing Surfboards. I mean, this was the heyday of the surfboard manufacturing industry.
Looking back on it, it is, but at the time, we were just doing what came natural, you know, the natural thing. Once I started building you know, I had lifeguard friends that I was building boards for when I had the little shop on the Strand. And then I was a member of the Haggerty Surf Club, and some of those guys were buying boards. And I guess it made people feel that I was a legitimate board builder, so I started getting orders. And then I figured, well, I got to get an electric planer, so I went and bought an electric planer. And then I started making too much noise in this shop because I was right next to a restaurant. Then I got kicked out. So then I moved up to a little industrial building that's a little more inland. And that's where it really all started to be a real commercial.
Yeah.
More than just a play fun thing. It was a commercial venture.
Right. All of a sudden you are
truly
in business.
No real plan, though, for the future. I mean, we just took one day at a time, and it grew by itself. There was so much business in those days because there was not many people building boards that it wasn't a problem.
I mean, I would imagine let's say 1964, 65, something like that, between those guys that I mentioned and you, mm-hmm. you're looking at 300,000 square feet of manufacturing plant. Like, how many boards are you guys doing a year total? I know you can't count for them, but what were you doing? What was your best year as far as number of boards?
I can't say by year. I can tell you what we did by day, though.
Okay. We'll multiply that by 300.
Well, you have winter and summer, so it changes things.
Yeah.
But at that point, when I had this little manufacturing factory in the industrial zone, I was selling retail out of there. And then Greg Knoll had a retail shop on the highway. Hap Jacobs had a retail shop on the highway. So I figured I better get a retail shop on the highway. So I did.
Yeah.
And so then I was manufacturing in the industrial building, and I was selling out of the shop on the highway. And then I moved from that industrial place to another one down in Hermosa Beach, a bigger factory right next to the police station, actually, which wasn't always the perfect place to be with the crew I had. This is in the mid-60s, the early to mid-60s. We were making at one point, if you want to talk about the most boards we were building, it was in the later part of the 60s.
Yeah, okay. How many boards were we doing a day?
We were doing 40 a day.
40 a day.
Yeah. I had two shapers that could each do 20 a day each. They, Dan Bendixson and Mike Eaton. Mike Eaton's brother would come in at night and template 40 boards, 20 for Dan and 20 for Mike.
Wow.
And they would come in at 6 o'clock in the morning with their big Rockwell planers and that'll hash work. Them out, you know. And these were easy boards to build at that era, you know. It was the Karma and the Foil and those kind of things, and the blanks were pretty close ratio, and it was a matter of skinning them and the thicknessing and turning the rails and then my problem was keeping everything going, keeping the machines running, keeping the materials coming, the glass, the resin, the styrene, the acetone, and tape and sandpaper
and keeping the shop resourced, making
it run. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And how many boards were you sending to the East Coast? I mean,
at that point we were sending quite a lot.
Yeah.
We were sending probably 50 to 60% of our production was going to the East Coast. But prior to that, in the early 60s, I didn't even advertise for it. In fact, I said no dealers, please.
Wow.
Because, well, the way it happened, when we started, we all, on the highway, there was Hap Jacobs and Greg Knoll and myself, and we were all around $125 for a board. And then all of us, to the locals, we were all selling to locals. Then all of a sudden, the East Coast people find out about surfing, and they start calling us up saying, what's your wholesale price? And I went, heck, I don't have a wholesale price.
Yeah.
You know, what do you mean wholesale price? Well, we have to have a wholesale price so that we can retail it. And so that was a big problem in the beginning of the East Coast, West Coast distribution thing. But eventually it worked out where they added a little more at their end and we gave a little bit at our end. Mm. And it turned out it was never a good markup for surfboards, and it still isn't really.
Yeah.
But like clothing is a lot better than sport.
For sure, yeah. What about Becker? Was Becker in this think of South Bay Surfboard Building in the 60s.
At the time that I had Dan and Mike doing 40 boards a day, Becker was doing a good 20 boards a day himself at Rick's.
He was with Rick.
And then Greg Knoll was in one building. I was right behind Greg Knoll buildings, and then the Rick building was right down there, and the glass shop for Hap was there, right there in this group.
That's what I mean.
And there was more board. I would say there's more boards built there than anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Any other town in the world. I mean, during that period.
Yeah, you guys were just pounding boards out of there. Was all four shops were just moving tons of boards to the East Coast, all over the world.
Yeah, it was crazy.
What about, it seemed like it was a good time to make a living as a surfboard shaper. Like, I've seen pictures of Mike Eaton. I think he had some crazy sports car, like a Mercedes or something.
Oh, yeah.
And it seemed as if Mike Eaton was probably making a pretty damn good living. Like, in today's terms, I would suggest to you, maybe over $100,000 a year in today's terms, which then might have been like $50,000 a year. Yeah,
absolutely.
Like, he was killing it, right?
Both Dan and Mike were making tons of money shaping my boards.
Yeah.
For that period.
Right. Yeah.
But they were worth it.
And they were working hard.
They worked hard.
You brought in Dick Brewer, and you brought in Donald Takayama, and you brought in David Nueva as sort of a figurehead as well.
Okay. First one was Takayama.
Yeah.
And this was before that era where we were building
this
so many.
This is like 63, something like that.
Yeah, 63, 64. It's when I brought in Donald.
Didn't he come over to shape for Hap, and then somehow he ended up in your stable?
I think he came over to shape for Velzy.
Oh, okay.
Originally. And I don't know how I acquired him, but we were all surfing in the same place at the Hermosa Pier and this and that. And
Velzy must not have been too happy to have his star guy, or was
animosity? Wasn't a star guy taken. I think because Donald shaped for a lot of different guys throughout his time,
right? So it wasn't like he was just with one label, or
well, at a time he was
right.
Like when he was with me, he was with me,
right? And he was with Hap before you.
No, after. Well, maybe a little bit before, because Hap and Velzy were kind of together,
right?
You know, and so I think Donald shaped a little bit there, but. When he was shaped for me, he was shaped.
Was there a sense that you stole Donald Takayama?
No,
like how did it go down?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
All I remember is Donald and I became friends, and
he's like, hey, I need some work.
He wanted to build a model,
right?
His model, and I said, sure, let's do it. And it was very successful, really successful. He shaped them all.
They're beautiful boards.
Yeah, they're beautiful. And and then one day he said, there's this young Hawaiian kid that's a really good nose rider. Why don't we bring him in and make him a nose ride model?
Yeah.
And I said, well, that's fine, but aren't you worried that it will cut into the sales of your model? He said, oh, no, it's not a problem. It won't be a problem. I said, okay. So we brought David came in, and he was really young then.
Yeah.
And so Donald and I worked together, and actually some of my other shapers and stuff, and we developed the nose rider.
Was it Donald mostly that did
Donald,
David Nueva nose rider?
Pretty much.
That first iteration,
we all decided to concave, because this was just after the Tom Mori nose riding contest, where everybody experimented with things, and so the concave nose was the thing. And Donald said, let's turn the blank around. Instead of the kick in the nose, we'll put the kick in the tail, and that'll hold the tail down and make it turn better and hold the tail down for nose rides. And so that's what we did. And that board became really, really popular.
That board's popular to this
day. It's still popular.
And it's relevant in the water as much as it is the reverence that we have for it from back then.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's an amazing design.
Yeah. But anyway, then we started selling so many of those that it was cutting into Donald's boards. And so then he gets pissed off because he's being outsold. Something I told him that could happen and warned him. And so then he decided to go to Hap and make his boards at Hap's.
Okay.
So, he was a little tough to get along with at times, but he was always a good friend.
Yeah. Yeah, sweet guy, but had his moments like all of us, I imagine.
Well, and he's Hawaiian.
Right. And I have actually an upcoming in the next auction. We have a Bing Donald Takeyama model the auction, and it's a gorgeous board.
Yeah. Has it been redone?
No.
Yeah.
It has that black like slip check kind of up on the nose.
Oh yeah, you know
that's original, right?
Well, we didn't put it on
in
the factory, but guys put
whoever
bought it originally probably put it on.
Yeah. And it doesn't have a number on it, which is interesting. There was I looked because I knew you keep really good
records. Donald put his real tiny on the side stringers, not on the center stringers.
Oh, really? So I need to take a peek.
Yeah. Take a look at the side stringers.
If I come up with a number, I can hound you and you can find out the number.
I can find out who we built it for or what shop and the date it was built. Yeah.
Okay. I'll take a closer look. And then... Dick Brewer comes into the fold a little bit. I mean, you're really dealing with some understandably sort of large personalities.
Yeah. Okay. Before Dick Brewer, let's Keith Paul.
Keith Paul was before the pipeline.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he was. We did the.
Because Keith Paul to me seems like a transition era guy, and the pipeliner to me seems like 67, 68, like. But fill me in.
Okay. It's all a blur.
It's a blur. It's a blur for both of us.
Yeah.
Well, that's okay.
If I had my book here, I could tell you exactly when each of them came. Keith Paul first. Duke Boyd and I went to, I think it was Puerto Rico, to the World Contest or something in Puerto Rico. Whatever year that was.
Yeah, yeah.
One of those years. And we met Keith there, and he... seemed like a really nice young man, and he had a real interest to come to America, and so I made him a deal that he could come, and he was a shaper, so he could come and design his own model, which was the Australian foil. He did, and he lived at my house with my family, and he's such a good-looking young guy that all the little girls on our block, you know, they all thought he was just the...
Sure, and with that accent.
Yeah. Yeah, and with that accent. But, no, he was a wonderful, clean-cut guy, and apparently after he got his board going, I put him in a van. We had a van, painted our decals over on the side, and sent him back to Texas, and the East Coast to stop in shops and promote, and he was wonderful because he would go into a dealer and say, "Yeah, you need a whole bunch of these kind of boards and these kind of boards, and I'll get on the phone to Bing and we'll order them for you." You know, and he just did that.
I mean, that's
pretty
cool.
He just took charge, and he was a great
salesman,
and they all loved him.
Yeah.
And he surfed with all the kids from by the shops everywhere they went. He was just it was a real, real good year.
So you often characterize your business as sort of like, I don't know what I was doing. I was just showing up and I was working hard every day. But it does seem to me that there was some forethought into some of this, and especially marketing wise. Like you had a really great, people could count on a Bing ad in every single magazine.
Yeah.
And you had quite an incredible marketing effort. And I know that you give Duke Boyd some of that credit.
Well, I give him much of that credit. Yeah.
I mean, sending Keith Paul in a van
there was no advance planning on my part in the beginning. It was basically just get in there and build the boards that we got the orders for, and things developed. It wasn't a plan that here's our master plan that we're going to make work over the next 3 years. Forget that. We didn't have that. But when it became obvious that we had to advertise in Surfer, I did. I started with a small ad, and then they keep coming around and said, what are you going to add? Well, it was quarterly in the beginning, or annually in the beginning.
Yeah.
And then it went quarterly, and then it went monthly. And then, you know, it was about that point is when I met Duke, and he was coming in selling Hangtin trunks and stuff, and we became real good friends. And he started helping me with the advertising. So we did have a good advertising program, but it wasn't all planned out a year in advance. It was every what were you going to do for the next issue?
Right.
That's all it was. And there was no major scheme.
Right. There was no vice president of marketing.
We just tried to figure, and we did come up with some clever ads.
Oh, you did? Yeah.
Some really... So I enjoyed, rather than just have surfers standing there holding boards and stuff, I enjoyed ones that kind of had some humor to them and stuff like that. And I enjoyed doing that.
Yeah. And so from Keith Paul, I had mentioned Dick Brewer and sort of these bigger personalities. And I imagine Keith Paul was a big personality, but you bring in Dick Brewer, who's sort of this legendary guy already.
Right.
And you come up with the Bing Pipeliner, which is this incredible board.
Yeah.
Well, a game changer in bigger ways, I think.
Yeah.
A narrowed nose.
Yeah. Duke thinner. Duke and I had gone to Hawaii. We were spending a month or something in Hawaii. And I had somebody running my shop that I trusted. Well, Dan Bendixson and Brian McGinnis, actually, the two. And so we could spend a whole month over there surfing. And we had this plan, because Brewer was popular. I needed somebody like that, to kind of like I had Takayama and Donald and then Keith. And then I needed a new one. You know, so we approached Brewer, and we took a skilled planer and had it. I took it to the chrome shop to say, "Can you guys chrome this?" And they said, "No, we can't chrome it, but we can polish it." So they polished it, and it looked like chrome. So we had this shiny planer. You know, we took it over and made a deal with Brewer and presented him with this chrome planer. And we also put a air conditioning unit in at Surfline Hawaii in Honolulu, in Honolulu. And they had a little shaping bay, and we air conditioned it for Dick. And so he made the first pipeliners there, and then we started building the pipeliners in California too.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Dick did have, you know, he had his Jock Sutherland and a lot of Jackie Eberle and some of those guys riding pipeliners in Hawaii. So that was a good promotional deal. It worked out well for us.
Yeah. But another sort of big personality that can be kind of hard to manage, I imagine there's some interesting stories about Brewer. And I guess my next question is, as you go into the transition, the shortboard revolution, the transitional era, right? I guess they're just stories, but there's sort of, I don't want to say rumor, but there's stories that when the transitional era happened, when the longboard went to the shortboard, there's this story that's out there that you guys, and I mean the South Bay board manufacturers, mm-hmm. were like literally overnight stuck with warehouses full of longboards that
never happened. Never happened. Not to me, anyway. I don't know about the others, but I never had that problem. But also, this was the drug era, the hippie era.
And it was 69.
Yeah. It was popular in the early 70s and stuff. It was popular for the in-group kids as boards were getting shorter, because of the Australian influence, you know, they came over and basically started the shortboard thing, even though Dick will say he started it, but I think
Who started it?
Well,
McTavish, Greeno, or
I would say McTavish lit the fuse, and Dick was right on it.
Too. Right.
So, but they can argue about
that. Yeah, they will.
I don't care.
They have.
I don't care. But anyway, boards were getting shorter.
Yeah.
And several things happened at that point. It was the, like I said, the drug era, and the young kids were getting spacey and this and that, and there was a lot of some of the in-group local kids, you know, they didn't want the establishment, they didn't want labeled boards and stuff, so the garage built board was kind of a happening thing. And
did this drive you crazy a little bit?
It was frustrating. It was frustrating, because what was happening is I had this big factory, a bunch of employees, and a lot of the older surfers said, "Well, I'm not going to ride a shortboard," and they quit.
Yeah.
And those were the guys that were paying the money for the boards.
Right.
Some of the younger guys were getting deals or working deals and stuff. But, you know, we were making our living off of the
30-year-olds, 25-year-olds.
The older guys.
Yeah.
And a lot of those guys just said, "I'm out of it. You know, forget it." So I could see that I couldn't, the way it was going, I wasn't going to be able to continue making enough money to keep the thing working. So I started looking for something else to do.
Now,
and Greg went fishing, Hap Jacobs went fishing, Dewey Weber went fishing. Everybody that was a major manufacturer
went fishing.
Hobie sort of still had other things going on, the Hobie Cat and this and that. And so he his kind of factory stayed going, but ours in the South Bay, ours pretty much all went downhill at that point.
And during that era, like 67, 68, 69, whatever it was, whenever the shortboard revolution thing took place, was it, never mind that you had backyard shapers and sort of a new culture emerging, mm-hmm. was it also a case where boards were changing drastically almost every week, and it was hard to kind of keep a focus on what we should build?
Well,
yeah. Did people come to you like every month and go, no, that's not the thing anymore.
No,
V-bottom's lame. Let's go to...
We were watching. We were watching what was going on. We had our finger on the pulse pretty good.
But was it kind of keeping you awake at night going, things are changing this drastically?
No, the thing that was that was bothering me at night was the fact that we weren't getting the number of sales that we needed to have. And the East Coast really sort of shut down at that point, too.
Bonzer Brothers came along. Like, at some point, the Bonzer Brothers came along, and that seems like it was a resurgence for your brand.
We were adapting to shorter and shorter boards, as good or better than our competitors, I feel.
I think you might have been the only one that did it.
Well, possibly so. Yeah, because we had several models that were the shorter boards.
I mean, these other guys closed up shop. Hap closed up shop. Greg Knoll closed up shop. Rick closed up shop.
Right.
Out of that came, you were the only guy standing, in my opinion, right? Donald Takayama had his label now, and the other guys.
Kind of other guys up and down the coast, but in our area, I was probably the last one to
hang on. Did you hang on too long?
No. Just right.
And did you see?
Well, the Campbell brothers came in right about this time, Duncan and Malcolm, and they were young guys, long-haired guys. Not hippies, but really clean-cut, wholesome young men. And they had this design. And Mike Eaton was shaping with me at the time. And we brought them into the office. They had a little 8mm. They lived in Ventura, up by Santa Barbara. And they brought their 8mm movie in of their boards riding at Ventura, which was a pretty fast break up there, beach break. And we watched it, and both Mike and I saw some tracks that they were making, and because they had this three fin design, which had the runners as opposed to fins, and a double concave in the back, and their father, I guess, told them about the Venturi principle of going wide to narrow to wide again, and the concave, and that would add.
Oh, that's interesting.
Forward momentum and this and that, and they were saying the boards really work, the boards really work, and they were very crude, the boards they built, but we saw some tracks in those pictures, and Mike and I said, let's look into that. Let's go shape them, right that day we went into the shaping room. I went in, we had a shaping room where we each had a stall. We each shaped one that day. And
were Malcolm and Duncan overseeing the process?
They were there. Yeah. They're not necessarily overseeing, but because
they were 18 years old, and they're like, oh my God, I can't believe these old guys are buying this.
they were in awe of what we were doing, I think, how we did it. So
I bet.
And the boards came out real nice, and we let, Steve Stickemeyer and Drew Harrison and our team members ride them, and they came back saying, great, they're working great. So we made a deal with Duncan and Malcolm. We'd pay them a small royalty for every one we built, and they were just ecstatic. They went back home, saying, we got a deal. And they had previously gone to Dewey Weber. They got shut out.
Yeah.
And when they came to us, we were receptive, so they were stoked.
Yeah.
And we made a deal, and they were making a little bit of money, and we built them, and advertisers promoted it. And I think that's what made them.
Did you bring Malcolm on as a shaper?
No,
because Malcolm's he's chops somewhere.
He's a great shaper. Oh, well, they were building their own in their garage.
Yeah.
So they developed.
Yeah. They got better as they moved along.
And they learned a lot, I think, hanging around our shop for sure. Because we're still good friends. We still sell their boards out of our shop here, and by us advertising it, I think it made them acceptable.
Yeah.
I don't know if it would have become what they attribute their success to our
Certainly it was a tipping point moment when mainstream builders like, hey, we're adapting this cool thing that these two guys from Oxnard have brought to us, and let's...
But like Mike Eaton says in our movie, he says, some people, you know, when we first started making them, he says, some people thought it was a gimmick, but it was a pretty good gimmick.
Yeah.
The way he said it.
Yeah, no, those, yeah. That's a legitimate
and,
design.
It was, they were legitimate boards. And so. Yeah.
But so... At some point, you
but
do.
This was just a year before I decided I'm out of there because there wasn't enough. There just wasn't enough volume to keep a big company going.
I didn't want
to downsize into a garage or something. I didn't.
Yeah.
You know, I had a family at this point, and I needed some stability and security.
Yeah.
So I a friend of mine who Brian McGinnis who was my salesman for years, and actually he was the manager when I wasn't there. He ran the business when I wasn't there. He was, you know, I trusted him explicitly. He had moved to Sun Valley, Idaho, and got into a moving and storage company. And when I realized I needed something to do, I said, you know, we'd like to come up and visit. Is it, you know, when we saw it, how neat it was up there, how beautiful the country was, I said, well, you need a partner? You want to do something? he said, yeah, I could use it. You know, I could use the help and a little money. So I invested what I had left with him. And I just came from California in 74 where mini storage was just starting.
Yeah.
So when I got up there, I said, you know, there's no mini storage here. I said, we should really look into mini storage. So it took us a year or two before we realized... Well, we had to find some help because we couldn't do it financially. Mm. So we found a partner and bought our first acre and built some mini storages, and that worked real well. So we bought another acre, and that worked really well. And we now have 6.5 acres in two different facilities up there, and we are retired from it. So
it
was the mini storage that the moving company made a living, but it didn't allow us to retire.
Right.
We retired from the mini storage.
Yeah. And when you built these first mini storages, did you have, obviously you took some plans from something you learned here in California? If you,
well,
there
were companies that made mini storage buildings and we hired them.
I see. So developers are like, we know how to do this.
Yeah. And the first ones we started were what they call pole construction, which are big creosote kind of post and beam. The barns were made that way in the old days.
Right.
And then out sheeted with corrugated tin, you know.
Right.
And so our first section was that. And then as we got into later other, we developed in about 5 phases. So towards the end, then it's all metal construction, all metal buildings.
Yeah.
But they all look alike. They're all the same color.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're old now. They're
I bet.
From 76, 77 to now, was our, you know, those buildings are getting pretty old, but we keep them up. You know, we re-side them when we need to.
We re-asphalt
when we have to. And we have one meeting a year now to talk about
where you're going to go,
what we need to do here, and how's everything going. And then we have the moving company that we started, which we sold to our employees. They manage all the rentals for the self-storage.
So. Yeah. That industry is interesting.
It is.
It's kind of fascinating.
Yeah. Ray Benner, do you know Ray Benner?
No.
Ray Benner's a good surfer. He has mini storage up in Oregon, I guess, or up near Greg Knoll, wherever Greg is up north, Oregon-California border. But he has he surfs a lot in Baja, and I surf with him down there.
Yeah.
But he says the same thing. Great business.
Yeah, it seems like it.
So, I'm glad we did that.
Yeah, that's helped out. That's helped you out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I mean, we're more or less caught up because now you're out. Now you're out of the surf industry.
Yeah. Well, I'm back in it.
So. You are back. You ran into Matt. Yeah. Well, Mike Eaton carried on the Bing label.
When I moved, I licensed the Bing brand to Larry Gordon at Gordon & Smith for 15 years. And he would pay me a $15 royalty for every board. Mike Eaton would go down and shape them. And several of my other employees went down to work with them, some of the glossers and polishers, or the glossers and pinliners and so forth, went down there and worked in San Diego. And so then after 15 years, it was over with Larry Gordon. It was dwindling. It was slowing down.
Yeah.
And then Mike was going to open a little shop. So he opened a little shop, and he was building paddle boards and some surfboards, and he built the Bing boards. But like he says in the movie, he says, you know, I was a shaper. I wasn't a businessman. And that's true. So the Bing thing really faded a lot. Well, at this point, you know, I was pretty successful in Sun Valley, so I bought a property in Baja, and I was spending a lot of my winters in Baja surfing. And this one day in the year 2000, I was surfing a little beach break spot right near our place, and I came out of the water and was changing, and I was driving a dune buggy at the time, and this rental VW drove up with two shortboards and two kids in it, young guys, and we started talking. We were the only guys, the four of us on the beach, talking, and this one guy was looking at me, and he says, "Are you Bing Copeland?" And I said, "Yeah, I am." And he said, this was Matt Calani, and he said, "Well, I'm shaping boards in Hermosa Beach, and I even made some for Rick Stoner's son, some Bing and Rick boards, and I owe you royalties for that." And I said, "Oh, great." I said, "That's great." And he says, "By the way, I'd love to build your boards." And I said, "Well, Mike Eaton's been building my boards, and I would never take it away from him, but I'm going to be going back in 2 weeks. I'm going to be driving through. I'll stop in San Diego and talk to Mike." Well, I did, and he said, "Great. You know, we need a young guy with new blood, you know, to do something." And he said, "Send him down. I'll give him all the decals and stuff I have, the labels and things and templates, and he can run with it." And so that's how that developed.
Yeah.
And I went back through Hermosa Beach, and he paid me my royalties for the Bing and Rick boards, and we made a deal that he could start building the Bings. And so he went down to Mike Eaton's and got all the stuff, and he's been doing it ever since. And the first year or so, he was a great shaper. I found out before I even made the deal with him that he was a good shaper. He understood longboards, shortboards, mid-lengths. He understood the whole manufacturing process, and I knew when I made the deal with him that he was going to be able to handle the quality end of it. And so I was pretty stoked about that. But he wasn't really a great businessman at the time. He didn't keep really good records. For the first year or so, my royalties and stuff would be really late and this and that. And then one day, Hap Jacobs came in with his team rider, which was Margaret Yao, and he introduced her to Matt and wanted Matt to shape a Jacob's board for her to ride for the team. And so Matt did, and he and Margaret kind of got together and ended up becoming a pair, or whatever you call it.
They're married. they're husband and wife.
All of a sudden got married and started having kids and stuff.
Yeah.
And she turns out had a business major in college.
Yeah.
So she was very organized. She totally organized the whole thing. And really to this day, the combination of the two of them, what Matt can do in the factory to get the board, the quality of the boards done, get them done right, and her ability to run the other end of the business, the paperwork and the bookkeeping and together they, you know, it's hard to be a couple and run a business when you're living together.
Yeah,
but they're doing a really good job of that. I mean, the first year or so, I mean, there was some headbutting, but now when I'm down here, I stay with them, and they've got a really
they've got a really
good system worked out, and they're and the company's running very smooth, and they're doing really well, and I couldn't be happier.
I just now
my job now is just to be kind of an ambassador. You know, I come and when I'm in town, they let me stay in their studio apartment. I hang around the shop and meet people.
You're like a shop Grammy again.
A shop Grammy, yeah. Kiss the babies. Yeah. Hug the girls.
Just like at Velzy's. Go get a cup of Joe.
Yeah. And and that's what I like. And you know, and I just recently took a trip to France with Matt, and we visited the dealers over there, and they were all
stoked. How did that go for you?
Oh, they were overwhelmed with
stoke
with us. Yeah. I mean, just the fact that we were both there, and we signed posters and this, and we had one guy kissing our feet.
Wow.
I swear to God.
Wow.
He was, I think he'd been drinking a little
bit. Yeah, he might have been.
But anyway, he was so stoked, he was kissing our feet, and he wanted both of us to autograph his car. we did. But anyway, I mean, every shop we went to, we were received really well.
Cool.
And the boards all look really good. We just did the surf show in Orlando, Florida last week or so.
Well, that's where I saw you.
Yeah.
And I was Bing is, I mean, you've been in this industry for 60 years, maybe more.
Well,
70 years.
Last year was our 60th anniversary,
Well, thank you, Bing. Thanks for spending the time with us here today.
I enjoyed it.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Bing.
Thank you, Scott.